here.
It is my great pleasure to welcome back Yosho Virginia Ginny Matthews to this space. She has spoken here a number of times, often in conjunction with others, but not only that, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so tonight, as you know, she's speaking about 21st century women's spirituality, a new awareness. She has spoken before on similar or related topics. She is the subject of one of the chapters in this book that I'll point out to you, The Unknown She, one of the bestsellers I just noted in our store over the years, and has been working with her own teacher for over 35 years? 34 years, okay. That's close. is a real spiritual practitioner, and I would say even female warrior of the practice. So it's our great pleasure to welcome her back to this space. Thank you so much for coming.
I like that. Female warrior. Well, what I'm going to attempt to do tonight is make a little tapestry. I'm going to try to weave some threads together, some threads of my own personal journey, some threads of what I've encountered in literature, other books, and mostly encountered working with women. I work with women a lot, both in my dance and Pilates practice, with my spiritual practice in the last 8 years has been mandated by my teacher to create a woman's Rinzai Zen practice. So I'm going to get to that point. But I kind of wanted, oddly enough, to put it in a little bit of a past, present, and future context. And I'm also going to say how this, I mean, that's a huge subject, 21st century women's spirituality. And it was in response to Vipassana, who's created this series of workshops for her organization, the Integral Human Body. And she approached me and she said, I really would love you to do a workshop, an all-day workshop. What do you want to do? And I realized at that point that my first response was to address this broad idea of women's spirituality at its present conjunction. I had been, for whatever reason, been with so many women who I felt were a little stuck and a little angry, and I felt a little sad about that because I felt their energy was really, really tied up. And if any of my practices could help women move through those stages, get some healing, access their personal truth, access their experience, then that's what I wanted to offer at this workshop. So I guess it's like a mini preview of my workshop. So where did the journey for me, I guess, started quite young in the consciousness. Where's the point where a woman finds that perhaps they are not in the mainstream of the culture? Where is that point? And it's usually a pretty important point. For me, I was 12 years old and I was passionate about animals and I wanted to be a veterinarian. And my mother, God bless her, said, okay, let's go and find out how you can be a veterinarian. So we went to a veterinarian and we walked in and my mother said, you know, how my passion was, and he said, oh, well, she can't be a veterinarian. She's a girl. Girls can't. No, this is 1961. You know, I don't think they would do it in 1971, but in 1961 they said, women are not strong enough to handle the large animals of horses and cows. And if anyone's read James Herriot, his teachings, or his books, you can see that maybe the old practice it was. But anyway, it was my first stopping point. Wait a minute, I don't get to do what my passion is. And I think that that was my wake-up call. And then in school, I started realizing, wow, all the books we're reading are written by men, and I'm constantly having to translate. I mean, it felt like this constant attempt to translate these ideas, these concepts, these approaches to life, these experiences of life that were not resonating with me. So it was almost like reading a foreign language and having to translate. So I made the vow, I think it was 1971, that for 10 years I would only read books by women. And I did. And it was a very powerful experience. I started with fiction, and I'll just share with you the three that really resonated for me. The women who spoke to me most were George Eliot, Virginia Woolf, and Doris Lessing. And I really passionately read those books, the diaries, everything I could about them, sort of steeped myself. And then I went on to I encountered The Chalice and the Blade by Rainey Eisler, and that opened the whole world of the spirituality that we may call the spirituality of immanence, where divinity comes into the world, into nature, into the female body is especially expressive of that immanence because it's creative. Life comes through the female body. It was the goddess time. Barbara Walker's Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets, I believe, or something, something like that, was another eye-opener. And then taking a little further, I went to college with a woman by the name of Deirdre English, and she had written a book with Barbara Ehrenreich called For Her Own Good, which is was another eye-opener. So I spent a lot of time steeped into what, and I'm really glad to see all those wonderful goddess books there, to really learn about what I think people would call the matrifocal spirituality and culture that was in the past. And then, of course, what happened to that culture, as we know, through the witches, and For Her Own Good is a very good, clear delineation of how women were healers and they were demonized and things happened to them. But I also found myself getting very angry, very upset at the patriarchy. It seemed to be a stage many of my feminist friends were going through. It felt good to be angry. Anger to me is power, is a power surge. It doesn't necessarily, we tie it to people and events and places, but it is power. I really got that the birth of my third child when I was sitting in a restaurant going into transition. If anyone knows, that's a very difficult part. And this flood of anger was coming through me, and I knew, well, I could get angry at my husband who's sitting here. I get angry at, but actually this anger is just the power that I need to get through this situation. So the anger that I felt in confronting what had happened to women through a very difficult period was a kind of power surge for me to dig deeper into my own experience of demonizing the female or the woman in me. And it started in incremental steps. It was a long, long process. But I'm very grateful for the power or the anger that started and fueled it. But hopefully I wasn't going to get stuck there. There's this great passage where I was emerging from the angry feminine period. This is an album I made. I'll have to introduce this for a really dear friend of mine who committed suicide a few years ago by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. And if anyone has ever seen the movie The Bridge, mm-hmm. I was interviewed for that about this suicide. And he was the godfather of my firstborn son. And, well, I'll just read it for you. It was a great teaching from Jim. I recall quite vividly. Now, so this is like, yes, it's about 1981.
And who wrote this? You or?
I wrote this. Okay. This is at the, I think this was the ending of my 10-year period of studying women's literature and writing. I recall quite vividly a conversation argument I had with Jim as we were returning to England from Ireland. We had left my husband, Jim, at a music festival in Listowel and were spending a day or so in Dublin. It was a gray and rainy day, so we decided to just hang around in the hotel and soon got into a heated discussion on who had been more damaged by our cultural stereotypes, men or women. I was in my ardent feminist days, having vowed to only read books by women for 10 years to rebalance the time I had spent reading books by men. I went on and on about what girls and then women were up against living under the patriarchy. Oh, I like that.
So sorry.
That's okay. Jim just shook his head and said, "You really don't get it, do you?" And I, of course, replied, "What are you talking about?" Still shaking his head, he said, "Everything you've talked about concerning what girls and women have struggled with doesn't even touch the damage that the male cultural stereotypes does to boys and men." And I didn't get it then, but I do now. Raising three boys, watching my father, brother, and husband struggle with these issues, and of course Jim and his death. In sending off some pictures of Jim to my son Ian in Japan, my note said that if there is something to learn from Jim's death, it might be to examine closely what our culture expects a man to be and do. So that was my breakthrough, the beginning of my breakthrough, to realize that the polarization of the sex roles that happened so strongly, let's see, Ken Wilber says it, about between 4000 and 500 AD, 4000 BC to 500 AD, when we move from what he called a horticultural culture to an agrarian culture, that polarization of the sexes happened so strongly. When the plow came and women, it was very difficult for them. They needed the muscular strength of the man, and this polarization started to happen. And that the damage was equal. An equal fallout of damage, and that was my awakening through the years. It wasn't as all at once, of course, but through the years, that this hurts all of us, not just women. So one of the biggest translations that I find I've had to do as a woman in this culture is around feelings and emotions. That is really clearly been demonized over the years, if you want to put it that way. And I certainly myself experienced the shift from the shift from immanence as a young girl, loving nature, loving my body, loving, to me, divinity was in blades of grass, and then moving through encountering more the transcendence of spiritual practices like Buddhism. I did encounter my teacher quite young, in 23, and was just loved meditation. It was a transcendent. I could just leap over all those difficult emotion. You know, I could just sit there and even though, you know, some difficult emotions would arise, I could keep breathing and I could go up to the mountain and be silent. So transcendence, which is in our culture, was the next phase from immanence, I encountered. And, you know, it's some, I say to people, I was very male identified at that time. But I think it's more that I was very emotion phobic, is maybe more what I would say. And there's a beautiful, I encountered a very beautiful period in our culture where actually immanence and transcendence were in balance for a very short time, which we call the Hellenistic Age, where one was receding and the other was coming. There was this nice play of balance. And I fell in love with writers like Plotinus or the Neoplatonics. And I think that planted a seed of balance for me, even though I went off with transcendence, the idea that we can hold both. And I think that was an attraction of Buddhism, that male-female, yin-yang, form and emptiness were equal valuable forces. So what was I going to do with all these difficult emotions? I thought I would read this. This is a lovely book called Healing Through the Dark Emotions. It was great. I was listening to Ken Wilber's Brief History of Everything, which is quite transcendent and clear. And I was reading this, which is totally imminent. So I felt very balanced. Listening to the body's emotional language is often harder for men who are encouraged to develop strong body armor to defend against the fluidity and vulnerability of emotional energy, which in our culture is associated with femininity. Women are generally more in touch with their feelings, but that doesn't mean that women are necessarily better at emotional alchemy, which is her idea of taking the emotions and turning them. Women are socialized to locate feelings in the body and to name and express them more accurately than men. But we are also socialized to condemn ourselves for our feelings, and therefore we often abort emotional energy and don't reap the benefits of our emotional sensitivity. I thought that was a very succinct way of putting it, very succinct way of what was happening to me on the mountain when I could be very sensitive to these emotions and self-reflections that were arising, and I was totally resistant, and I was shutting the door on them because I wasn't, I had never been encouraged to invite them in. So, you know, 34 years is a long time to do a spiritual practice. And I think about 10 or 15 years ago, I think I was really tired of shutting the door on these emotional energies that were arising. So, you know, you can also get a little bored up there on meditating for 7 days. So I decided to play a little game. And I decided that I would befriend these emotional energies, and I would name them, and they would be my companions on these 7 days. And instead of shutting the door in their face, I would open the door and invite them in for tea. And if they were really rambunctious, I would say, you know, just go sit in the corner and have your tea. I really don't want to deal with you right now. And it was, so they all arose, and they all had names. So Lucy Lonely came, Sadie Lou Self-Loathing, Chrissy Perfection, Roger Resistant, I don't know why he got a male name. I guess he had a hard energy to him. And this is a game I played, but it was delightful because in one sense I could step back a little and not be so totally identified with them. And the other sense was I was not expending so much of my energy in shutting them out. And I found this miraculous thing would happen when I did befriend these. They became pussycats and they became companions, and I could be more whole, and I could bring all of this together and not leave anyone out the door. And it was a great practice, and I hope in our workshop we'll get to practice that. Everyone can have, you can do a meditation period, and we can name and invite in these emotional energies that probably we've spent a long time keeping outside the door. And I wanted to do another little exercise with you. Another thing we all talk about is the dissolving of the ego. That's a very big thing in Buddhism, dissolving the ego. And I never, you know, that has an abstraction to it. And then at one time, I guess maybe it was reading about the Indian philosophical idea of the chariot and the driver is the ego, and it gave me an idea, and I said, well, you know, in our culture, what is the chariot? What is the modern chariot? It's the car. And when I realized that so many of my dreams have cars in them, or, you know, my car's stuck, or I can't find my car, and I realized that the car had become kind of a symbol for my ego. So I'm going to invite you to consider your personality self as a car. And I want you to think about what kind of car is your personality self. I collected a few Matchbox cars, but not enough to pass around, so I didn't bring them around. I tried this. I was talking to my middle son, and he said, well, Mom, that exercise wouldn't work for me because I really don't know that many cars. But I figure you all know cars from, you know, we certainly have a lot of Priuses around here. You know, what is a personality self that is a Prius or a Chevy van or a sleek Jaguar or an MG Roadster? So you want to take a moment? You don't even have to close your eyes. I want to just take a moment to think about if you were to choose your personality self as a car, what would it be? Do you have one?
All that came to my mind was a snail.
Oh. Let's see, how would that translate? That's okay. Anybody else come up with a car?
A Batmobile.
Ooh. Batmobile. Fantasy.
Wow. One of those James Bond ones.
Anybody else?
Convertible.
Did you go? We've got a convertible?
Mm-hmm.
What did you?
A Volvo.
A Volvo. Present day or old?
Older. Not a wagon. No.
So what is it about the Volvo that suits your nature?
I'm not sure.
Strong?
I've never had one. I just like the look of them.
Uh-huh. Volvos are particularly
kind of
safe. Dependable, safe. That, you know, you could feel safe in a Volvo.
Uh-huh. An old Saab.
Yeah. Aren't they wonderful?
Red, dark red.
Dark red. So what is it about the Saab that suits your nature?
It's round. It's really round.
It is really round.
And kind of looks like a bug. It looks animal-like. It didn't look like a car. Yeah. First car I saw, it didn't look like a car.
Good. I came up with a really like 60s vintage VW van. And so I was trying to inspire that, and it's, well, you know, you just get stuff a lot of people in there, and you can go for long, you know, just, it was the, in our day, it was the car you traveled across the country in. Mm-hmm. You know, it was good for long hauls, and it was very welcoming. Mm-hmm. And brought people in. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think I like about myself, and that's my personality. Mm-hmm. So, if you could, so if you think of yourself as the car, okay, I'm the VW van, this is my car, I get to get out of it sometimes. I get to step out of my personality self and experience life a little differently without the armor and without the construct. Car is quite a construct. Oh, that's the other thing I like, a VW van, very simple construct. And it's been a very good exercise for me to look at the personality self more lightly, with a little humor. I mean, a little humor goes a long way, especially in spiritual practice. So these were some, you might call them devices or helps, to encounter this particular practice as a female who's dealing maybe with emotional energies, and wants to befriend them, wants to bring them in, and also to deal with the idea of the ego self as not totally identifying with the ego self. And for women, that maybe that's even a little harder, as it gets also involved in the body self. We're both, yes, women are wonderful transmitters of the immanence of the divine, and unfortunately that has got distorted in our culture, and we tend, and our culture has only seen the body. So I deal with teenagers all the time as a dance teacher, and that is a huge or huge discussion we often have about self-loathing around body issues and trying to fit a perfectionist norm. And what I like about Ken Wilber has this great thing about, well, yes, first we had immanence, then we had a little balance there, and then we went into transcendence, and then the Enlightenment hit, and we just have flat land. We have neither the divine coming into the material world or we sending the divine from this world, but what we have is the belief that all there is this materiality that has no divinity, no purpose, no, and what he calls flat land, and there's no life, and it's gray. And it's what it feels like with my young girls who see their body as it. They don't see the divinity that comes through it, that comes into it, or the divinity that can emerge from it. It's just this body, and it needs to be perfected. It needs to fit the cultural norm, flat land. So since I work a lot with young women, and older women, I have spent a lot of hope or time, I don't know how quite to put this. Sometimes I get discouraged about how to bring a little color into Flatland through feminine energy. Did anyone see that film Pleasantville, which has that idea of the gray, and that the color comes in through the feelings, through the passions. I sometimes I get discouraged about how will our institutions change to embrace the feminine and to embrace back the equality of immanence and transcendence. What would our culture look like if that was its reality? So I thought I'd bring another little exercise tonight. And this time we should probably take a little longer time, maybe a little meditative time. Let's give the parameters here. I'm sure, and I'll address the men also, because I'm sure they go out into the world and they see things that they need saying, well, wait a minute, that image is not me. I need to see something that resonates with me as a male in this culture that's more true to my nature. Well, and women, we go out in the world and we see images thrown at us, or we experience things in our workplaces, in our institutions of schools, hospitals, the larger collective institutions that say, whoa, that does not reflect me, that is, can even be abusive to who I am. I really want that to change. Does that resonate? So if you were to take a moment and try to find a place or something that jars you when you go out into the world, or something that really hits you the wrong way at work or in the institutions, and you could change that, what would it look like? So we're going to do a little visioning exercise. So let's take a minute or two here. Fortunately, my list keeps getting longer. but it's been a very, very helpful exercise for me, because if I can envision change, then perhaps it can happen. Anyone want to share?
Mine's simple.
Mm-hmm.
Mine would begin with just saying, turn off your TVs. Just erase that.
Uh-huh.
That alone has so much power and influence.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it might take some time to erase the memory of what was there. that's mine.
That's great. Well, my pet peeve is the billboards the advertisements on the muni stops in San Francisco. there are all these very sexualized young women in underwear. And I'm thinking, you know, that doesn't appeal to me. And so I, instead of reacting, oh gosh, here we go again, I said, so, if you don't like seeing young women in underwear, what would you like to see at those muni stops? I said, well, I think I would like to see a very full body grandmother type who is smiling with real grandmotherly love.
So in underwear?
Not in her underwear.
In her own corsets.
So I could be reminded of that nurturance of the grandmother. And maybe, you know, I would go through my day a little bit like, oh, yeah, that lovely grandmother energy. It's there. And I would be reminded of it at the muni stops. Yeah.
But that's got to be, that same entry into San Francisco, I made it many times. And I know the, I can almost say the name of the clothing designer whose billboards those are. What is it?
Benetton.
This must be my angry female. But for me, my first response to that is no. I want to see them. I want to see the dude and his muscles and the Calvin Klein. That's what I want to see.
Oh, but they're there too.
I want as much time spent on that imagery as there has been on the female. Uh-huh. And then, like, I guess again, that's my, you know, trying to get it into balance mm-hmm. for a while. Like, we have to extreme it the other way in order to get the other half to see it. Uh-huh. You know, that's what I beg and pray for. And you know, and maybe now I'm getting old enough.
Like,
they
used to have them.
They did used to have them.
Yeah.
They're
really
yeah.
They're
really
yeah. Their underwear
parts.
Did anyone else have an image?
I had an image of the culture talking to each other, people habitually talking to each other with receptive listening and. Mm-hmm. Having really hard conversations as a just tradition. Mm-hmm. We could expect that.
Uh-huh. Anyone else?
I had like the reverse image, which is that I thought of all the times I've walked down the street and I've passed somebody that I've known and they don't see me. They walk by me because either I'm out of context or they talked to me once and they don't remember me. And I think there was a part of me that wants people to see again, to be aware, to be awake, to be alive.
Mm-hmm. Any other specific?
Mine is kind of general, but it's so much of what we see is propaganda promoting something, whether it's a government view or a manufacturer's view. And there's so many stereotypes. I just like to see pictures around that were not designed to inflame or incite, mm-hmm. but more something more yeah. like she said about something calm, like, mm-hmm. like something that would invite reflection and dialogue. Rather than immediate triggering of passions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mean like greed?
What?
That kind of thing?
Like,
inquisitiveness.
Well, like anything, like even my religion's better than your religion or whatever, anything that people tend to get.
Competition.
Yeah.
That kind of.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is a little connected to what you said about turning off the TV. I would say turning off your program. we're turning off our program. And a little, with what you said about listening, people hearing each other, listening to each other, I'd like to see more sign language, less talking, mm-hmm. more body-centered body-centered language, because I think our language has us kind of trapped in our heads and in our brains, and I want to see the language change. And I actually believe that a lot of our woundings are attached to our language, so that moving into a different idea of language would release a lot of our preset ideas.
Well, and there is that precedent, that book that said that moving into language did move us away from that sense of imminence of the sacred lying, being in the body and being wanting here on this earth.
The observation of women that I see, particularly in leadership positions, who don their masculine energies to create the achievement that they're after and the control that they're after, and really lose sight of the sacred feminine. Mm-hmm. And what that mirrors back to me is the need for me to continue to cultivate my sacred feminine so that those characteristics are what I bring into the world and what I bring to that position of leadership. Which is a different model,
mm-hmm.
and it applies to men also.
Of course, yeah. Well, one of the most interesting things that are happening around this time is passionate discussions about our Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and who actually is holding the feminine and who's holding the masculine. And it's been wonderful. To me, it's been just a great period to have these conversations and to wake up a little, you know, to be aware. So whatever happens, I'm really grateful for that.
Especially for young women.
And young men.
Yes.
I see that with my three boys. I'm just going to throw another one at you. I worked at Annalee High School for 6 years, and there'd be times when I'd walk in and there would be posters splashed across, "Kill El Molino, kick their butts." And, you know, so there goes that reaction, you know, gosh, here we go again. How are we ever going to evolve if we can't even get out of competition football? And lovely Sebastopol, Annalee High School. So actually, a really lovely thing happened. The drama teacher got tired of all these rallies where they were screaming. She said, "Well, we're going to have a rally about the theater arts and the music arts." And she did. And she got the school together to celebrate the arts. And nobody was shouting "kill" or "kick their butts," or so. And they talked about expression. You know, we like to do this because it expresses ourselves. And so it was a little step. It helped me again. Yes, we can envision this. If you can envision it, it can happen. Did you have a?
I have one. I have this one. I've had this one before. It's kind of fantastic that we get out of the combustion mode of energy, burning things up, and that all the cars have crystal rooftops and the roads are crystal, and somehow the photons move. And it's really beautiful because it's just reflecting light. It's light moving to light. But when you brought this up, I was like, oh, how would that change everything? But it's the idea of not consuming mm-hmm. to make things move, but just exchange. And it's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
It's delightful.
These are all very lovely. So, as I said, I did at the beginning share with you, I think about 6 or 8 years ago, my teacher said to me that I really wanted me to help create this women's Rinzai Zen practice. And it was an exploration of, okay, is spirituality divided between men and women? Is this something that is needed? Or is this, in fact, most of the women in my community were very upset about this idea of the women having their own practice, meditating together, just women without the men. They said, we've worked so hard for equality. How can you do this? It's like undoing it. And I just had to go by my experience. And my experience is that I needed desperately to heal as a woman. And that the way I was going to heal was with other women. And I got a vision. Actually was at a workshop that Anne, and it was a vision. The first was the grandmothers came of the native tribes and said, women just need to hold each other and rock them and soothe them. And that will help the healing. No criticizing, no comparing, just hold each other, rock. The other was, women have a great gift for communication, and the 21st century is the age of communication, and women can really take this into a great weaving. I saw a great web of light. Many people have seen this web of light, but women particularly were just really working this web of light. And I'll go back to that communication thing. And the third was, women have to sweat together. They just really have to get to work together, sweat together, whatever that image was. And so I took that, and in our retreats that I do with women, we try to do all those. The communication is actually first in silence, and then we usually end with a communication space. And I feel strongly the need for this healing so that immanence and transcendence can be together again in equality and in the incredible strength of both, and that we find balance again in this world. And so that's my work right now, and I'm delighted with it. I do women's retreats. I also do mothers and children retreats with my community. I'm doing all women sit at a Yamtha organization in Grayton once a week. I do zazen at my studio, which is open to all. And Laura and I have been starting to do an introduction to meditation course, which is open for all. But I particularly urge women who have maybe not had experience of meditation to learn this practice, because it is such an excellent self-inquiry. I mean, I certainly have learned a lot through this practice. So there's some flyers. The workshop that I will be doing some practices that I worked with new mothers. I was a new mother leader for a birth center. And with the birth of my third son, a lot of, what shall we say, skill and confidence in my intuitive life emerged. And with the help of these women, those skills were honed. We did communication with the unborn, communication with children who may not be quite articulate. And let me tell you, it was a godsend when my boys hit puberty and when they were too angry to talk to me. So we did I did spirit-to-spirit communication with them, and it always worked. You know, they'd go to bed furious at me, and I'd do my meditation. The next morning, go, oh, hi, Mom. How are you? So I'm going to do some of those practices because I think this is a gift often of women, especially moms, but not always moms. But it's interesting. I've taught this meditation, if you want to call it, to hundreds of women. And only one was not able to get it, and she was a doctor of philosophy, I believe. So I feel this is in native to all women. So those are some things that I want to cover in my workshop, and I tried to give you just a little taste. So the brochure is there, and it's great sharing your visionings, and I'll always think of you as a Volvo. Oh no, in a Batmobile. Okay. So do you have some announcements? Thank you, guys.
Thank
it was
you
lovely
very much.
To share this with
you.
Thank you, Jenny. Appreciate
You're
it.
Welcome.